Hello, so I'm Anthony, and this is work I did at University of Illinois with my colleagues Frank and Hui and my advisor Sam. So I hope you're a little curious about what digging for data structures is, but first we're going to take a small side tour, and we're going to talk about polymorphic viruses and the situation of the antivirus industry. So I have this cute little graphic that shows the AV vendors being chased around by the giant bugs, and I actually saw a quote in Slashdot this summer, which was the VP of Cisco or somebody high in Cisco. And he said, you know, why are we even running these antivirus programs? Because they're failing to detect viruses. And, you know, you're going to run a firewall and you're going to run antivirus and you're still going to have to wipe your machines and you're still going to get infected. And from a technical standpoint, it's not that hard to figure out why this is happening because current AV techniques are basically grep with some additional flash. And there's a large number of things you can do that will change the byte values of your program, but leave the program intact. So you can encrypt your program, which is, you know, you have a very small little piece that decrypts it first. You can do code polymorphism. So you replace one sequence of instructions with another sequence that's different. It has different byte values, but does exactly the same thing. And finally, you can insert garbage into your program in a way that it's tough to tell that it's garbage. And the worst part about this is that most viruses only use number one here. They just do a whole lot of it. So when you look at those that list of techniques, we can take a couple of the generalizations. So the first is that they're all code. So the implication is that if we did a memory-based detector, at least temporarily, it would work pretty well. The second thing is that, by definition, these virus writers want their obfuscation techniques to be very mechanical. So you write your virus, you run your magic wand, and you get 500 viruses that you can now go and plague the world with. So if you have to do your own input to make those new copies of viruses, it's not nearly as valuable to you. So what would be great is if we had this AV technique where we could say, well, you know, maybe I'm not sure what this program is, but I can at least say that I think you created it with some sort of obfuscator. And we believe that one feature that you can detect on that solves all those constraints is the data structure. And the reason is that a lot of people use data structures. And the reason is that they're told to use them when they learn how to program. So whether you go to MIT, Stanford, or, whatever school you want to pick on, the point is that you're all going to be taught to use data structures, and so they're pretty universal. So our theory is that malware authors also went to school, and they also learned how to program using data structures, and so we can detect their malware based on those data structures. And just to give you sort of a hint on the kind of argument I'm going to be making, imagine that I have a piece of code, and the polymorphism, the way it hides itself, is that every time it reads from memory, it XORs it with a value. And every time it writes to memory, it XORs it with the same value. So the memory image will look exactly the same as it would normally, except that every word is going to be XORed with this magic key. So your memory is encrypted, and we can't find anything. But at the same time, all the data structures disappear. And so we can say, hey, you know, you don't use data structures. You must be, you know, from, you know, Krypton or whatever. So the only problem with this scheme is that malware doesn't tell you the data structures. They're not nice enough to include their debug info. So this then is finally digging for data structures. We're going to look into this process image, and it's going to look like a bunch of random hex values, but we're going to be able to pull out the data structures. And so we're going to say, aha, you know, these two are the same, and those two are the same, and maybe we can leave that across programs. So that's the talk. First half is going to concentrate on detecting data structures in programs. And the second half is going to concentrate on detecting programs with data structures. So the trick we're going to use is we're going to build up from the bottom. So there's a few things we can say about any specific word, right? We can say it's zero. That's easy. And what's really interesting, though, is that we can say whether or not it's a pointer or an address with pretty good accuracy because we know where the heap is. And so if it's really the address of an object, that object will be in the heap. And so we can look at each 4 bytes, and we can say, okay, is this value between the start and stop of the heap? We can also look for some simple things like, is this a bunch of characters? So is this probably a string? So we can say like a number of things about these small groups of memory. And then we can also map those things into what you would normally do when you write a program. So you're writing your operating system's research program, and you go to define your structure, and then you're going to add some fields. So like you might add an ints or an int pointer, string. And it turns out there's a pretty good probabilistic mapping between the atomic types, which are the things you would add, and the block types. So basically, you can see that integers are usually data elements. Zeros are usually zero. Strings are usually characters. Pointers are pointers, and so on. The only trick is that zero can be anything. That's sort of the wild card. And the other, the empty cells are, quote, real small. So they're not zero, because you might have an integer that happened to have a value that would, you know, be into the heap. It could happen. But it's unusual. So our system is probabilistic, and it can handle that, but usually it thinks that's wrong. Okay, so now we're going to go over an example, which I hope will make all this real clear. So imagine that we wrote our program, and that's the black piece of code on the right there. And it's a doubly linked list of strings. So it has a next pointer and a previous pointer and the target and the size. And then we ran it, and it created the following heap. So there's three structures in this linked list, and they reference two character arrays. So now I wave my hand, and all that goes away. And now we see the, you know, the operating system perspective. So we look at it. We just see a whole bunch of bytes. So the first column is just the address, and the second column is the value and the character value. So the first thing our system will do is it will go through and it will compute, given the value, what's the block type. So that's the earlier thing that I said, what can we say about each individual machine word. So 0x20, is it 0? No. Is it a string? No. Is it a pointer? No. So it's an integer. It's what's left over. 0 is easy. 650, 028, that happens to be within the bounds of the heap, so we say it's an address. And we just go through down the entire table. It's very mechanistic. So now that we've done that, we need to find the objects. And the way we do that is we look at all the pointer targets. So basically we take the set of all the pointers, that's the start of all the objects, and then their end is the start of the next object. So that gives us five objects. Amazingly enough, they seem to be the same five we had before. And then we're just going to pull it out. All I've done is wrote the same stuff on the other side of the screen. And now I have grouped them into two different groups. And if you see, remember I said that zero can sort of be anything. So the three in the upper group seem to be pretty similar. They're mostly address data. So this is a data structure where the first three elements are pointers, and the last element is an integer. The bottom two are strings and integers. And so it seems like a pretty good idea that the first three are in one class and the second two are another class. And again, this happens to correspond pretty well with what the actual example was. Now, the other thing that's pretty interesting here is you can see I wrote down the actual, next to the objects, I wrote down the actual class definition that our system will figure out. And you notice it doesn't say pointer, it says class one pointer. And the reason it does that is that when you define a pointer, you don't define a void pointer. You define a type pointer. And so if we really have this doubly linked list, the pointer will refer to an element of another member of that doubly linked list. And so basically, if the system has done things correctly, the pointers should all refer to classes that are basically all the pointers at a certain offset of a certain class should point to elements in the same class. Okay, so I hope you understand that. If not, come talk to me. We also have a mathematical basis for this, but I'm not going to talk about it. Mainly, the thing is that I sort of waved my hands and said, we're going to put these three in this class and those two in the other class. But in fact, that's a very difficult question when you have, you know, 4,000 objects and 50 classes, so you have to have some mathematics that tell you what to do. The other question is, how many classes? So again, I sort of waved my hands and said two, and that was pretty reasonable, but again, do you have 50 or 51 or 52? So we just use a standard unsupervised Bayesian classifier, and it basically just gives us a very large equation that says, given this current solution of, you know, mapping of objects and classes, how good is it? And then our system, we call it Leica. It's 5,000 lines of Lisp code. That is, in fact, Leica there. And all it does is it tries to optimize the Bayesian model. So it'll just perform simple heuristics like merge two classes or move one object to another class, something like that. And it turns out this is actually pretty tricky. So first of all, not too surprisingly, we can't actually solve this. We have to, you know, use heuristics. But what's less obvious is that only 30% of objects contain pointers in the sample we looked at. And so what that means is Leica is trying to put two objects together by saying, well, this object is, you know, address data. You know, it's certainly like a list of something. The other objects say string integer. But most of the objects are just strings or data buffers. And this is why the type pointers are so important, because we can classify an object not based just by what it looks like, but on the objects that point to it. We also had trouble with certain overly clever programming practices. So if you have a union between a pointer and an integer, that'll give LICA some trouble because that's breaking its assumptions. And we were especially irritated at the X-Window developers because we did tested a lot of GUI apps. And the X-Window developers like the tail accumulator array. So LICA assumes that all classes are a fixed size. Tail accumulator array is where the last element is a variable size, so the structure is a variable size. So that hurt our results a little bit. So we ran our programs in GDB, and then we basically trapped on malloc and recorded the type, the real type of the allocation. We had 7 test programs with an average of 4,000 objects and 50 classes. So these are real applications. These aren't, you know, toy things. We did, you know, XPDF, that kind of thing. And we measured the probability that LICA actually did the right thing and correctly reconstructed each individual object. And to give you an idea of how much we get penalized by the system, this will actually consider that we did the wrong thing if we had, say, a double buffer and a character buffer and put them in the same class, which, as you can see, LICA will do this every time because it just says it's data. So what we did is we measured the probability that LICA actually did things right. So it's the probability that if 2 objects are really in the same class, that LICA put them in the same class. And if LICA put them in the same class, what's the probability they're really in the same class? And it turns out that if you can maximize one of those metrics by putting everything in the same class, and you can maximize the other by putting them all in different classes. But maximizing both of them is hard. So without any typed information, we get about 65-70%, right? If we tell it where the objects are and how big they are, but we don't tell them the class, we get about 70-80%, right? And when we remove the objects that don't have any pointers, we get about another 5%, so 75-85%. Okay, at this point, I'm going to switch gears. That's the data structure detection half. Now we're going to move into the virus detection half. And just to remind you, this is based on the structure. So we don't care what the actual field values are. If it's, you know, a 1 or a 2, the point is it's an integer. So imagine you can just rip out all the structure definitions and compare them. That's what we're going to be using here. And we think we have a really cute way of doing this because LICA, the data structure detector is 5,000 lines of code. LICA, the virus detector, is 50. And the reason this works is because we can use this really slick trick. So if you look at what LICA actually does, it takes a program, and let's say we have red is one data structure and blue is another, and it pulls them out and puts them into classes, right? And let's say we do it correctly, because, you know, I get to pick the example, and it actually does it correctly in this slide. So imagine we take 2 programs and we weld them together, right? So now we have program 1 and program 2, and again, the 3 different colors are 3 different types of data structures. And the interesting thing here is that blue is a data structure that's in both programs. And it's LICA, just by doing exactly what it does normally, puts those into the same class. So now we have, I'm going to change the coloring scheme on you, and blue is from program 1, green is from program 2. You can see class 1 is only in program 1, class 3 is only in program 2, and then class 2 is a mixture. And so what we can simply do is we can measure, you know, how many of those classes are mixed, how many of them contain structures from both, and how many of them are just structures from one class. And so class 1 is a 1.0 mixture ratio because it's all from program 1. Same for class 3. And then class 2 is 50-50. So basically, if the mixture ratio is close to 50%, it's going to mean that the 2 different programs share a lot of data structures. So we want to know if a program is an instance of a particular virus. So we run it in a sandbox, and we take a snapshot of its memory image. We download the sample memory image from a repository, and we run the 2 images with LICA, and we look at the mixture ratio. And now we're going to classify the unknown program as Kraken if the mixture ratio is less than a certain threshold. So the only thing we have left to do is pick the threshold. And we want to do that in a more or less rigorous manner. So what we did is we downloaded a whole bunch of samples of the virus, in this case it's Kraken, and we measured their mixture ratio with our signature. And so that gives us a nice distribution on the left. We picked a Gaussian for just because it was easy. And then we picked a whole bunch of normal programs, like BitTorrent or Firefox, and we measured their distribution versus the signature. And if the system actually works, then those 2 distributions should be separate. And it turns out that this actually works pretty well. So we did 3 botnets, We would like to do more, but it turns out getting these things to run is really irritating. So we did 3 botnets, average of about 25 samples per and about 25 normal programs per. So it's about 150 tests. Like, I got all of them right. So anytime we ran Kraken, it was correctly classified as Kraken. And every Agobot was classified as Agobot. And every normal program was classified as safe. We also have the estimated accuracy number, which is basically the amount of red in that previous slide that I showed you. So it's the overlap. And that also is about 0.5% or less. So this we think that basically means the classifier is confident in itself. So this, we think this compares pretty well with ClamAV. So ClamAV did well on Storm, but it only got about 83 and 85% on the other two viruses. So now I guess what a pretty fair question to ask is, well, you guys have sort of, you know, taken them by surprise, you know, gone around the back, but virus authors are going to adapt and they're going to try and beat your system. So the answer is, of course they can. Virus detection is an arms race and the bad guys always win. And so the philosophical points I wanted to make first are that, first of all, the mixture ratio is very simple for us. It's 50 lines of code. We think we can do better. Obviously, the virus authors haven't done anything yet, so they can probably do better too. What we have here is just, I'm just going to sort of talk about what we can do. But the other point I'd like to make is that because Leica is a memory-based detector, it synergizes very well with a code-based detector. So if you do some work to beat a code-based detector, you probably won't beat Leica. If you do some work to beat Leica, you probably won't beat a code-based detector. So there's a nice defense in depth there. So as I said before, the simplest attack is you encrypt your memory. So every time you read, you XOR. Every time you write, you XOR. And again, the problem is that this annihilates all the data structures. So as the attacker, you have to do something a little slicker. So the first thing you can do is you can shuffle the field orders. This is going to make it look like your data structures are different. Now, two things you can do. First, this only removes half the information. So we still know the actual contents of the data structure. So we can still, you know, be we're just going to be less confident than we were before. The second is now you have to distribute your source code or some sort of higher level language or higher level representation of your program or otherwise include GCC in your distribution of the virus. So there's a certain annoyance factor there. Second thing you can do, and this is also pretty slick, is you can try and make your program use the data structures of an existing known good program. So you can try and shoehorn your data structures into some, say, subset of Firefox. So we can have two defenses on that. First is we can try and show that you're not actually using all those fields. You're just sort of hiding within the subset. The second thing is we can ask, why are you using Firefox's data structures? You're not Firefox. There's also some straightforward limitations. So as like a sort of a high-level structure thing. So it's taking all the information we know, throwing out a lot of it, and concentrating on the upper level. So if you have a very simple program, then there isn't any higher level structure. So if you have some very simple worm, you know, that just copies itself and exploits a buffer overflow in IIS, then it probably has no high level structure. So one of the arguments we're making is that, you know, lately botnet authors are trying to make money. And that means sending spam, that means having these, you know, control networks, that means doing denial of service attacks, and that's going to mean more code. That means you have to sort of run your malicious server on the computer. And hopefully that means more data and more data structures. Also, Leica is sort of a dynamic system, so you have to run the code, which is going to have some overhead in terms of the amount of work you have to do. But maybe we don't care because, you know, we've got all these hardware guys that are doing a great job. I'm not going to talk too much about related work, you know, because that's... But I just want to shout out to Wisconsin because the best related work is all from Wisconsin. It's all from different people. So... Big tent. So, conclusions. First of all, we can find data structures in program images. So we think this is pretty cool, and I hope that, like, most of you guys, when you read the paper, were sort of surprised that we could do it. And secondly, we think that high-level virus detection is sort of a sweet spot because as a virus author, you have all these tools that you can use to, you know, transform your program into something incomprehensible. And one of the things we did as we were writing this paper is we sat down and we sort of brainstormed, you know, what could we do if we were writing viruses? And first of all, we concluded we could do a lot better. But it's really pretty disgusting what you can do with these tools. And so the hope is that if you have this idea that, well, maybe they aren't maybe no one would write a program this way. You can at least sort of, you know, put those tools back in the box or make them harder to use. And we think that statement also itself is a little bit surprising because, you know, where it's so many different people and they all program and think in different ways and they write different programs. But, you know, there are some things, you know, to quote the Blues Brothers, that make us all the same. So, that's the talk. I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll take questions.
Hi, Stefan Savage, UC San Diego. A very nice bit of work. I have a couple questions. One is about the challenges involving getting a consistent snapshot of memory, which seems to be an assumption here. And I mean, some of the good malware these days is actually, for example, careful not to do all of their evil deeds at once, or maybe not do them until a particular time of day or upon receiving a signal. And so figuring out when that is, and is the bane of the AV person's life. And it seems fairly essential to this approach.
Yeah, so actually it turns out we did this really simple thing. We ran it for 5 minutes and we looked at the data structures. And that actually worked surprisingly well. But no, I totally agree. Our personal belief is that you just won't be able to get enough information out of static and you'll be forced to do dynamic. But now you have this very, very big challenge of, you know, how long do you run it and what do you look for? So yeah, you're totally right.
Okay, and the quick follow-up question is, there's a whole class of non-malicious applications that make extensive use of obfuscation. And they are particularly those that are affiliated with protecting the intellectual property of people's software. And they do it to code, and a bunch of them now do it to data as well. And I'm wondering if you think that there's a characteristic signature of people who obfuscate their data for the purposes of malice versus those who are doing it to protect.
I don't think you could do that, but you could certainly sign your program.
Okay. Christo Wilson, UCSB. This is totally awesome. It's great work.
Thank you.
My question is, and a lot of your examples appear to be very C-centric, the types of data you're looking for, the way the heap is managed. Have you tried running your detector against things written in other languages or using more exotic compilers, and how does that affect the results?
So it depends. So we talked in the paper about how this will fail utterly on something like Lisp, right? So in Lisp, you know, it's all lists, you know, what do you know? Also on some high-level languages, you don't even need to do this because you just have all the information there automatically. So if you're doing this on Java, you already have all the classes. We haven't actually looked, so it will work obviously on C++, but that's probably not what you're looking for. We haven't really gone too far beyond just actual machine code, so we ran on the viruses, and we assume whatever they're written in, it works. But beyond that, I can't really answer your question.
Thank you.
Jonathan Durg, University of Utah. So one arms race here that you don't really go into is that the attacker code might try to detect whether it's in the sandbox or not, or in, you know, in the VM that you set up. And so the question is there a way to bypass this arms race as well, or, you know, if... Or can it just do something different, i.e. not malicious, if it detects it's in a sandbox, and have a more randomized data structure set up because it's not actually trying to do anything at all. It's just trying to confuse you if it knows it's in a sandbox. So is there a way to sidestep this?
So like as a dynamic detector, it's going to rely on a working sandbox. We didn't worry about that at all. We just sort of assumed it worked. And at least it worked for our three viruses. So take that as you will.
Stefan Serio, Microsoft Research. It's a follow-up on the question you just got. So it's actually even about C. There's a lot of programs out there that have a lot of shared data structures, and they're not malicious. People use libc, or, you know, in the case of Java, you have JVMs and so forth. Like, how would your technique actually deal with trying to, you know, kind of classify these programs as good programs, not bad programs?
Okay, I guess I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. So can you maybe... So you're saying, like, if I have a program that uses maybe, say, a library.
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't do anything.
So you're detecting that a lot of programs basically share the same data structures. Well, that data structures can be like something in libc, let's say. And that's a good data structure. So it doesn't mean necessarily that's bad. Sharing data structures across programs doesn't mean it's bad necessarily, right?
Okay. So basically the argument there, what you're looking at is the mixture ratio. So that what the trick there is, well, maybe you're still using libc, so clearly you're going to be using some of the same data structures. The question is, are you using enough, right? So, you know, I see what you're saying now. It's a good question. The main trick we used was the actual training. So we could say, well, how close is it? And have a nice quantitative metric for that. I hope that answers your question.
Hi there. Petros Maniatis, Intel Research. I was wondering if it would make sense to forget about the bad guys. They're going to win anyway, as you said. But apply this technique to understand programs that might be buggy. For instance, it looks like I should have list nodes in this part of the heap, but this one doesn't look like a list node. Maybe something is going on in the runtime. Have you thought about using the technique for something other than bug finding?
I just got emailed by one of my colleagues at UIUC that there's a Popple paper on doing something sort of like this, except they basically assume you know the structure definitions because you have the debug information. So actually, we thought a long and hard about other applications, and it's sort of tricky to find them because the basic problem is so much of the time you already know your own data structure definitions. So you need to look at a situation where you don't know your own data structure definitions, and that sort of puts you into the realm of security. Does that sort of answer your question?
It sort of does. I was thinking about scenarios in which you don't have the source code and you want to do something like failure oblivious computing where you're trying to figure out some way to fake it without having the source code. And it sounds like what you have, if you assume some sort of uniformity of how the heap is used spatially, might help you say, well, this should be a list pointer, so I might as well fake one. Just a random thought. I don't know.
I think it might work. It's going to depend on why you don't have the debug information, I guess. Thank you.
Scott Walchuk from the University of Michigan. So this is sort of related to the other programming languages question, except you singled out ASCII strings as a category that you might find. And I'm just wondering if like will get confused by programs that have strings in literally other languages and they're encoded in like UTF-8, and so you'll never find a string.
We detect UTF-8. Oh, we just call it ASCII.
Perfect.
So,
Sergey Melnik, Google. If I were to write a virus, I could serialize and encrypt all data structures before you put them on the heap and use them as real structures only on the stack. Could you deal with that situation?
I didn't quite hear you correctly. So you said that if you're going to put all the data structures on the stack, basically.
Okay. So I take a data structure, serialize it, encrypt it, and then allocate memory on the heap and put it in the heap. And then when they read it back, I just leave the data structure as is on stack.
Okay, I'm still not understanding this, so try again.
So,
okay,
I wrote a class. I have two methods, serialize, deserialize. Before I allocate memory on heap,
okay,
I call serialize and encrypt the object and then put it on the heap. Then when I pull it back there, I can decrypt it and leave it only on stack while I'm using it.
So I think that falls into the whole concept of like encrypted memory where, you know, again, we can't tell what you're using, but at least we can say we're very confused because if I have two versions of the structure that are encrypted, they won't look like each other at all.
So it's just a very simple generic approach that they could use. And so you're saying you cannot tackle that.
So the trick here is that you have to be very careful about the kind of detection you use. So the analogy I like to use is, you know, I'm going to have to like, you know, people are going to say like, check my fingerprint, you know, before I enter the bar. So I cut off my hand, right? And now I have no fingerprint. You know, I press my bloody stump against the thing and it doesn't show. You know, but I mean, at that point, you know, at the same time, you're very conspicuous because you have a bloody stump, right? That's sort of the idea, right? So maybe we can't actually say, oh, we see those data structures, right? We can't, like, I'd say, you use the same data structures as this other program, right? But we can say, you're not using anything at all. That's very conspicuous. So if you encrypt everything, Leica's going to get very confused. So if you don't understand why, I can talk to you offline and try and explain that.
I have one question. I had the same question as Stefan, actually. But when I heard you said you run it for 5 minutes, I got really worried because you got to run your Leica against every candidate virus program, right? And I guess there could be thousands of those, and then each one's going to take 5 minutes.
Oh.
Is that right? Or
So that's not quite right. So the question of how Leica would deal with a huge, huge system of viruses is we haven't dealt with it. So as structured like as linear time, check one, check two, check three. So clearly that's not going to work if you have 500,000 signatures. when I said run it for 5 minutes, what I meant was the unknown program. You run it for 5 minutes. And then you can compare that against each test. Now, Leica actually runs pretty quickly itself. It only takes about 60 seconds, maybe. It's actually, our results are really weird because.
But you have to run Leica against every candidate program together, or you can run it once and then have something.
You run once, you take the snapshot, and then you compare that snapshot
against
the different ones.
I guess it's a little bit better. All right.
It turns out that like Leica has basically polynomial time in the number of classes and the number of objects. So it goes as you go for really complex systems.
All right, thanks. Okay, so everybody stick around. We have some announcements here. All right.